Clause number 13-19-503-CB, Esteban O. Brown versus Florence Nocar.
Ronald Hull, Your Honor, for the appellant. Maybe 10 minutes and 5 minutes.
Okay.
And Jared Clark, Your Honors, for the appellee, Florence Nocar. We're going to reserve our 20 minutes, but if time allows, we are happy to cede some time back to the court.
Okay, that will work. We appreciate that very much. You may proceed, Mr. Hull.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. The main question this appeal, of course, is whether this is a healthcare liability claim. We've got three basically things that the court has set out to prove that it's a healthcare liability claim. One is that the defendant is a physician or a healthcare provider. There's no dispute about that one in this case. The third one is that the alleged damages were caused by his actions, and there's no dispute about that. The only question is this a healthcare liability claim? And of course, at first blush, one would think that it's like, well, no, this is not a healthcare. This is a simple garden variety assault or dating gone terribly wrong or something like that. But if we actually look at the presumptions that the court has set out in Loisega versus Cerda, it becomes clear that the Supreme Court would consider this a healthcare liability claim. So why do I say that? Well, if we look at Loisega, it talks about the analysis that you're supposed to engage in, and you're not supposed to look at just the pleadings, which in this case alleges two singular assaults. But if you look at the background, the evidence that was presented during the hearing on the motion to dismiss, her deposition testimony, her notice letters, you look at all the background, that's what the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court has said you're supposed to look at. They said specifically in Loisega that analysis of the second element, the cause of action, focuses on the facts underlying the claim, not the form of or artfully phrased language in the plaintiff's pleadings. And they've said previously, you look at everything that's down there, everything that the court had to look at to determine whether this is a healthcare liability claim. They also pointed out one of the key—
Mr. Hull, yes, you rely quite a bit on the notice letters because as I understand it, much of what was said in the notice letters was not included in the pleadings. So, do you believe that those are judicial admissions?
No, they're not judicial admissions, but they are admissions, Judge. And one of the things the court can look at is admissions. And we don't have just have two. We have one by her first attorney who said this is a healthcare liability claim. We have one by her individually saying this is a healthcare liability claim. And we also have in her deposition, her admitting that this is because he was a doctor, I trusted him. He basically, and I guess the lack of a better word, she's saying that he tried to seduce me by some kind of transference or something because he was my doctor, I trusted him. He groomed me is what she says a lot of times. And so basically because of the fact that he was my doctor, he encouraged me and in fact convinced me is what she says several times in her letters to have sex with him. Key point that they said in one of the first notice letters is, and both of them say that he basically convinced her that he should be the one to inseminate her with his sperm when she went to him for basically fertility issues. And again, while there's some case law that clearly says these are not judicial admissions, and they aren't because they weren't in a pleading, they certainly are admissions and some of the things the court can look at. But we need to look no further than that.
How do you distinguish the Randall Mill Pharmacy case that Appley has cited? Of course, the court does use, this may be Appley's language, dispositive judicial admission. But in the Randall Mill Pharmacy case, the Supreme Court said that these pre-suit notices were not dispositive in terms of triggering the expert report requirement.
Right. And I agree wholeheartedly with the Supreme Court on that because it's not a judicial admission. It's not dispositive. However, when you have admissions, those are certainly things you can look at to determine whether or not this is looking at the whole facts. Is this a health
the whole picture?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you don't need to look even further than the plaintiff's brief, which says they testified. And this is on page 15. That he says in her deposition, she testified that her healthcare liability claims were separate from her sexual assault claims and that the notice letters were for the healthcare liability claims.
I have a question about that. So did she actually file some separate healthcare liability claims? Is there a lawsuit for something like that? Or what are you talking about?
We believe this is that lawsuit, Judge. You can't have the same set of facts and then claim it's healthcare liability claim and then claim it's not. In fact, the Supreme Court in Loisega addressed that directly when they said, it follows that claims premised on facts that could support claims against a physician or healthcare provider for departures from accepted standards of care directly related to healthcare are healthcare liability claims, regardless of whether the plaintiff alleges the defendant is liable for breach of those claims. They said clearly you can't determine a claim if you have one set of facts. You can't determine or splice it up or divide it into both the healthcare liability claim and another type of claim.
Right, right. I just was a little confused by something that in Appley's brief as to whether there was actually some separate claims that were made.
Yeah, no, there were.
But how is this even related to a healthcare claim when his own actions, as they are alleged, how can you say an assault is related to healthcare?
Well, you can't. And that's why not the Supreme Court, but in other cases, they said, while this court can readily agree, and this is, I'm citing from, I think it was in our brief too, Bueno versus Hernandez case, it's 454 Southwest 2nd 178. They say, while this court readily agrees that sexual assault of a patient is not within any medical standard of care, to proceed with the claim without the benefit of an expert report setting forth the appropriate standard of care and any breaches would require the trial court to assume the truth of their allegations. And you can't do that. You have to look at the case and look at the underlying picture and have they alleged something that's a healthcare liability claim. And in this case, we have to remember a healthcare liability claim could be any claim departure from the standards of medical care, healthcare, or safety or professional or administrative services directly related to healthcare. And in this case, they even cited in their notice letter, and we cited in our brief, their allegations that this violated the Texas Medical Board rules, this violated medical ethics, and basically she's alleged all along this would not have occurred but for the fact that you were my doctor. Because you were my doctor and I was your patient, that is why you were able to convince me to have sex with you. And again, these are going by her allegations that she put in her pleadings. And you have to also remember.
So you're saying in your brief that the doctor has denied that there was any consensual relationship at all?
No, what my doctor has denied is that there was a doctor-patient relationship. Basically, background to this is she came to see him. Yes, correct. And then he sent her a letter saying, I can't represent you because I'd like to date you. Would you like to meet me? And so that's it. That's the end of the doctor-patient relationship. She alleged, and that's what she's claiming in all these letters, that this went on and on and on and on. Now, we said that we denied there was any consensual sexual relations before the doctor-patient relationship was terminated. Because there was a doctor-patient relationship, but we say, and again, that's not covered because we have to go by the four corners of the pleadings and everything, but our position was, you know, immediately terminated the relationship, never saw her again, except for one time when she told him she was pregnant, and he went to the office and said, well, let's find out, and basically used the sonogram to find out if she was pregnant, said, yeah, you're pregnant. Okay, that's one of her allegations in her pleading. That's a sexual assault that she says was battery, basically, because he didn't get informed consent, he didn't do this. So those are allegations that she's made in her pleadings and in her depositions and in the underlying case that are clearly medically related. The other one that's clearly medical related is saying that he put her in a frame of mind that this was not something, you're never gonna have a baby because I have this basically condition,
the fibroid,
right, and that he lied to her about that, and that's, you know, that's clearly medical negligence as well.
Okay, let's talk about the rebuttal evidence, because you're saying that the presumption applies, and so now they need to rebut it, and they have argued that these alleged acts occurred outside of the office and during this consensual relationship that's being alleged. Why is that not sufficient to rebut the presumption?
Because the Supreme Court has said you look at, and they specifically talked about healthcare liabilities, claims, and assaults. That's in the Losega case versus Serta. They specifically says, we conclude, and this is their holding, that a claim against a medical or healthcare provider for assault is not a healthcare liability claim if, and these are the ifs, the record conclusively shows, and again, not just some shows, conclusively shows that there is no complaint about any act that's provided related to medical or healthcare services. In that case, we've got the complaint about the fibroid, the complaint about the non-consensual sonogram, things of that nature. And two, that the alleged offensive contact was not pursuant to actual or implied consent. And in this case, all these sexual relations, according to her first two demand letters, and in fact, even in her deposition, say, that there was, you know, consensual. She had consensual sex with him, but she was under the impression that he loved her or something like that, and that she couldn't have babies. And so basically he groomed her, according to her. And in the brief of appellees, they even say that these health care liability claims are separate and apart from her assault claims. Well, again, the Supreme Court has made it very clear you can't separate them if it's the same set of facts. The third requirement by the Supreme Court is the only possible relationship between the alleged offensive conduct and the rendition of medical services was the setting in which the act took place. And in this case, we have two of those that don't fall in. You have to show all three to rebut the presumption, and all three have to be shown by a conclusive record. And we don't have that here. We've got, first of all, her two admissions in her notice letters, one what represented by counsel, and the other when she specifically said, you groomed me because you were my doctor. We also pointed out in our brief sections in her deposition where she said specifically that, you know, it's because he was my doctor, I trusted him, I believed in him, and that's why I allowed him to have sex with me, things of that nature. And so, as pointed out by the court, Bagley, which you were on the panel, Judge, Chief Justice, he said the court concluded that if there is at least an indirect connection between the claim and the provision of health care, we are bound to rule that the claim is a health care liability claim.
When was Bagley decided? Was that before?
It was in 2019, Judge. That was just last year.
Sorry. Yeah.
It's after, and again, they cite in large part to Chris Despond versus Sanchez, which is one you were also involved with, but that was a decade earlier in 2009 and before Loisega. The case, this court in Rogers versus Bagley was after Loisega, and the Chief Justice yourself was also on that one. But in that case, you did find that there was a health care liability claim, but because it was a 1983 action, you felt there was some preemption issues that kept you from throwing the case out. But again, it was noted then that if there is at least an indirect connection between their claim and the provision of health care, we are bound to find that's a health care liability claim. Okay. So looking specifically at the Supreme Court's guidance. I'm sorry.
You're out of your time. Unless you'd like.
Oh, sorry.
Well, you'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal, so.
Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Jared Clark, and I represent appellee Florence Nokar here on this appeal. This, of course, is an appeal, an interlocutory appeal of the trial court's denial of appellant's motion to dismiss this case under Chapter 74 for failure to serve an expert report. The standard of review is de novo because the issue squarely before this court is whether or not the claims being asserted by appellee are classified as healthcare liability claims under the statute. And the Supreme Court has said that when you are making that determination under the statute, the standard of review is de novo. In summary, Justices, the trial court correctly denied appellant's motion to dismiss under Chapter 74 for three reasons. The first reason is that element two of Cierda is not met. That's the element that requires that the plaintiff's claims arise out of some alleged departure from accepted standards of medical care. That's not the issue here, and I'll get more into that in a moment. The second reason is that element three of Cierda is not met. Appellants say that that's not in dispute. It actually is in dispute because what that element requires is that the plaintiff's damages were proximately caused by some alleged departure from the accepted standards of medical care. And that's not what proximately caused plaintiff's damages. It was the appellant's own actions, his actions committing sexual assault that proximately caused the damages. And then the third reason that the trial court correctly denied the motion, Justice, is because those pre-suit notice letters, as we were discussing a moment ago, are not dispositive of the issue. Although appellant heavily relies on them, they are not dispositive of the issue as to whether or not these are healthcare liability claims. And the facts underlying these claims are simply that appellant at one point lived in California and she moved to Texas. And when she moved back to Texas, I believe this is where she's from, she decided she wanted to have a child and she started a doctor-patient relationship with the appellant, Dr. Brown. And the allegations are that at some point, Dr. Brown became infatuated with the appellant and sexually assaulted her on six different occasions. And now what appellant has pointed out numerous times. He only usually refers to either one occasion that happened in the office or, as we were just discussing, something about a fibroid. However, there are five other occasions that don't even occur in any medical setting at all. And just because you have two other occasions that do occur in a medical setting doesn't mean you can lump a bunch of separate acts into there to try to say that all of those are also healthcare liability claims, because at some point there was a doctor-patient relationship. You can't do that. In fact,
it just seems that there's a really blurred line here, because obviously they did start off with a doctor-patient relationship. And I'm assuming this was a consensual relationship up until a certain point. I don't know. It's not real clear to me yet how six acts would occur without any consent whatsoever. But be that what it may, is, you know, at what point do we determine that there is no doctor-patient relationship?
I agree, Judge. It was difficult. I had to scour the record a little bit to determine where that line ended. And it appears that it was at the point in the office where he probes her. According to her
last episode, that's because she said that's when she terminated the doctor-patient relationship, was after that happened. Was that the last of the six, or was that?
No. Not according to what I've seen in the record. That episode apparently happened in mid-December 2014. And then she's got allegations in December 2014 or January 2015 that there was forced intercourse that appears on clerk's record page 224. And that apparently happened at appellant's home. Also in January 2015, there was apparently an attempted rape where he tried to take off her clothes, ripped off her clothes, groped her. That also, according to appellant, took place at appellee. That apparently also took place at appellant's house. That appears on clerk's record 275 through 77. And then in mid-November 2015, there are allegations of forced oral sex. And so all of these occur after the vaginal probing episode. And so how you can try to lump all of that in to say that they're healthcare liability claims is beyond me, unfortunately. And so getting to the elements under the law, Sarah, that requires that one, the defendant is a healthcare provider or physician. And we agree with appellant on that point. There's no dispute amongst the parties that Dr. Brown is a physician. The things that are being disputed are elements two and elements three. And addressing element two, the first thing that appellant argues is that the claims are presumed to be healthcare liability claims. And the reason they argue this is that under Cerda, claims are presumed to be healthcare liability claims if they're against a physician, which again, nobody is disputing. Dr. Brown is a physician. And they're based on facts implicating the defendant's conduct during the course of the patient's care or treatment. It's very difficult to argue that it's presumed to be a healthcare liability claim if these actions took place at appellant's house or appellee's house, and they're not even remotely connected to any provision of care. These are allegations of sexual intercourse that was forced, allegations of forced oral sex. How that can be even remotely related to medical care is beyond me. And so they're not presumed to be healthcare liability claims, and you can't lump them in there because at some point there was a doctor-patient relationship. Simmons versus Outreach makes it clear. Sorry, Justice, I think you're trying to talk. I think you're muted.
I wasn't muted and I muted myself. All right. I think the guys went to lunch, so I don't think there's any construction going on right now. So I'm just going to leave it on.
Okay.
All right. So let's go back to those acts again, because you're the acts at home. Okay. Strong argument there. But you do have the acts that occurred in the office that are arguably medically related. As Mr. Hull argued, we can't really separate these acts. If there's some relation to this doctor-patient relationship, then the presumption arises, doesn't it?
Not if they're separate acts. So the presumption arises if the act occurred and it was related to medical care, which is why Mr. Hull is saying, well, look, they were in the office. He was using the probe to determine if she was pregnant or not. But what he's also trying to do is lump all of the other separate acts into there to say that those are not separable. And they are. They have nothing to do with medical care. and that's why they're separable. Holguin says that it would defy logic to suggest that a sexual assault is an inseparable part of the rendition of medical care or a departure from the accepted standards of care. And that's all we're saying here, is that the separate sexual assaults that allegedly occurred after the probing episode, those are all separable from the provision of medical care under Holguin. And so
relying on the Holguin case is that that's before Losiga. I don't know how to pronounce that case name.
I worked all morning on that.
No, of all people, you should know, Mr. Ho. Anyway, Holguin was I forgot the case year. I don't have it in my notes, but it was before
2012.
Yeah, so before Loasiga.
It was okay. Well, there was
that's changed. The standard has changed a bit.
Well, also, this court said in Sanchez that when a claim is unrelated to the provision of health, that individual can't hide behind the procedural safeguards of Chapter 74 merely because he was a physician at the time of the assault. And so that's all we're saying here, judges, is that just because you were a physician at the time of the assault doesn't mean that you can hide behind the procedural safeguards of Chapter 74 just because you were a physician. And I believe that's what the courts have to wrestle with on these cases, because oftentimes the act comes close to the line. You can have an episode where somebody is maybe conducting a breast exam or something, and so there's a question of whether or not he's actually performing medical services or if there's an actual sexual assault going on, and that's what the courts have to wrestle with.
Sure.
Here we don't have any of that going on. We have instances of forced sexual intercourse at their home, either at the appellee's home or at the appellant's home. Those are the allegations.
But if he's at his home, that it just seems to suggest that she was there of her own volition and she was consenting to be there, at least, maybe perhaps not to have sex, but there seems to be some element of consent on her part to be involved in this relationship.
And I've scoured the record to try to figure out, justices, whether or not at some point it was consensual and then it turned non-consensual. And it's not very clear from the record whether or not at some point it was and then it wasn't. I've looked at the deposition testimony and it was difficult for me to find whether or not at one point this was, and then it maybe they had a breakup and then it turned non-consensual. But what I can say, justices, is her allegations in her deposition testimony is on clerk's record 179 was that the instances that she's bringing up, at least in this suit, were never consensual. That's clerk's record 179. It's the depositions transcript that was made part of the record. It's the transcript page 128, lines 7 through 11. The allegation she's making here is that these instances were not consensual at all.
We have to take those as true.
Sorry?
We have to take the allegations as true?
I believe so, Justice. I think I agree with Ron Holt that you can look at the entire record, but I think the record here makes it clear that she's saying that. Now, of course, Brown will say that it was consensual, but the allegations from our client are that the instances that happened in this case were non-consensual. And so our position is that the court should take that as true.
Is there any, as far as the background facts, she obviously went in to have an appointment and she needed a sperm donor, what my recollection of the record stated. Is there any way that the sperm donor relationship, if there is such a relationship, could make that a medical health claim, that he was pursuing that in the nature of medical health?
I think that would be a stretch, Judge, because and I would have to read the medical ethics rules about whether doctors can proceed in those relations with their patients to donate sperm in that sort of way. But I think that would be somewhat of a stretch. Getting into element three, justices, so that element, of course, requires that the departure from the accepted standards of medical care proximately caused the damages. We discussed earlier what Holguin says about that. I know that Ron Hull disputes that Holguin is still good law, though it has not been officially overturned by any court. Sanchez also says that when a claim is unrelated to the provisions of health, you can't hide behind the procedural safeguards of Chapter 74. The final point, as you were pointing out, Justice Contreras, is that pre-suit notices don't trigger Chapter 74. The Supreme Court made that pretty clear in Randall Mill Pharmacy versus Miller. They stated, we declined to hold that the plaintiff's allegation that she provided notice under the Act by itself constitutes a dispositive judicial admission that these are healthcare liability claims, because that's what the pharmacists were trying to do. They were saying, look, they sent us healthcare liability pre-suit notices. King's ace, we win and game over. These are judicial admissions. The court was like, no, what's important is what is at the heart of these claims and how the elements under the statute, how it defines healthcare liability claims, how it applies to the allegations that are being made. It doesn't matter, as Mr. Hull has stated on his argument, it doesn't matter what's put in pleadings, but also I think under Randall Mill, it also doesn't matter what's put in pre-suit notices. What matters is what are the allegations that are being made and how does the statute apply to those allegations.
He did testify in deposition to some of the to the relationship, saying that he abused her trust because he was her doctor and manipulated her into having sex with them. So that's in deposition testimony. So clearly that's something the court can consider.
It is, Judge. I think it is something the court can consider. Again, I think, I was scouring the record to see at one point if this was consensual. All I can point the court's attention to is at least at one point it became non-consensual, according to the appellant, under her deposition testimony. And so at the end of the day, what matters is whether the claim at its heart is a liability claim based on the factors in CERTA, not how it's cast either in pleadings and litigation or in pre-suit letters pre-litigation. And so in summary, justices, the trial court correctly denied the motion to dismiss because this is not a healthcare liability claim. The claims did not arise out of some alleged departure from standards of medical care, and her damages were not caused or approximately caused by the departure from accepted standards of medical care. They were approximately caused by appellant's own actions committing acts of sexual assault. And for those reasons, justices, we ask that you affirm the decision of the trial court. And unless the court has any more questions, we'll cede the rest of our time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Hull, you have your remaining 5 minutes.
Thank you, Justice. We agree that it's not dispositive. That doesn't mean that
you put 8 on the clock.
That's fine. I'll try to give you back 3. But at any rate, we agree that in the case that he was citing, that one involved a pleading that said we gave pre-suit notice. And so they're saying that in itself is not a judicial admission. To be a judicial admission, it had to be in a pleading. We don't have that. But what we do have under the Texas Rules of Evidence are admissions. These are admissions of a party opponent. And if we look at those admissions, it clearly sets out exactly what they were saying. And they were saying that, and it deals completely with this and also what Justice Perks was talking about, you courted this patient who discovered was longing for a child and convinced her that you should be the one to inseminate her with your sperm. Okay, that's basically medical negligence. You can't do that. Again, they also said you used her personal identification, her medical information, her medical history, her mental health information, all of this to immediately start a romantic relationship with your patient with the intent to culminate a sexual relationship with her. Again, a deviation from the standard of care. They even point out that the conduct he's talking about, and you can't subdivide it, this is all the conduct we're talking about, you violated the rules and regulations of the Texas Medical Board, the Texas Occupation Act, the Texas Medical Association Code of Ethics, and they put all that in those admissions. She later then confirms that when she sends her own notice letter telling him, again, it's a healthcare liability claim, and these are admissions, not conclusive, but it's part of the underlying facts, and then you convince me that you should be the one to inseminate me with your sperm. Again, that's basically she comes to him for artificial insemination. She says the doctor convinced me he should do it. Those are healthcare liability claims. And again, she points out he violated the act. But we go back to what this court said in Sanchez, and that's really old law. That was before Loisaga. And if you look at what this court did just last year after Loisaga, you pointed out that if the court concludes there is at least an indirect connection between the claim and the provision of healthcare, we're bound to find that as a healthcare liability claim. Looking real quickly at Loisoga, again, it says, we previously determined that a claim based on one set of facts, which is what this is, cannot be spliced or diced, well, they say divided, into both a healthcare liability claim and another type of claim. If you have some of it that's healthcare liability claim, it's all healthcare liability claim. And as the court pointed out in her deposition, she pointed out that you abused my trust, you were my doctor, you manipulated me into having sex with you. Clearly seems like it's consensual there. And then even above that, she said, this was sexual exploitation. There are just layers of unhealthy in that relationship. It was an unhealthy interpersonal relationship because she relied on him as a doctor. One of the things that is important to note also is not only did they in their brief say that there were healthcare liability claims, but we're not bringing them in this case, even though it's the same set of facts. But in the when the court was having and struggling with the same thing, well, when did this sex occur? When did it happen? Mr. Rodriguez said, well, there were some sexual intercourse that occurred while they had a doctor-patient relationship, but we're not complaining about those. Well, again, you can't sort it out. If we look at her actual petition in this case, she's only alleging two instances. She said on or about December 15th, 2014, which was clearly before the doctor-patient relationship ended, and again on January 10th. He's naming eight or nine things that she talked about in her depo, but in her pleading, she's only talking about those two. Again, you can't cut and dry it and splice it up and try to make it not one. So if we look at the factors the Supreme Court said you're supposed to look at, it is a healthcare liability claim unless all of these are involved. One, there is no, absolutely no complaint about any act of the provider related to healthcare. We don't have that. We've got the insemination, we've got the fibroid, we've got the sonogram. Two, the alleged conduct was not pursuant to implied consent. Well, there's consent all over this. When she said, you convinced me, you did this, at least that's implied consent. And then the only possible relationship was the location. And some of these did happen in his doctor's office. But again, we look at that and say, has that been conclusively established? And if it hasn't, all three of those, then it has to be a healthcare liability claim. I also scoured to try to find out if there's any case dealing with this. And the closest I could find, and I don't think it's in my briefing, but I did find a case called Sunsinger versus Pettis, which involved basically a family practitioner who had consensual sex with his client, with his patient, and she sued him later. And this is not a healthcare liability claim action. It's basically, I mean, it wasn't decided on that issue. It was a summary judgment issue and whether or not it was they had a fact issue. And again, the court in the summary judgment
on that case,
that is 16 Southwest 3rd, 496. And it's Pet refused. Pet denied 9/7/2000. It's a 19.
You have used your 5 minutes, but did you ask for 10 and 5 at the outset or 10 and 10?
I asked at the outset for, I think, 10 and 5.
Okay. The clerk heard 10 and 10, so that's what she put.
Oh, good. But if I can just finish this up real quick.
Okay, anyway, just wrap it up, please.
Okay. In this case, it involved a patient that sued the doctor saying that he had had sex with her. And they specifically, what's important is on page 2, they said, she appears to assert that there is a cause of action for negligently having sexual relationship when there's an existence of any professional relationship. And they said she has not presented any authority that this would not fall under professional malpractice, and we're not aware of any. So even that case seems to think that having sex with your patient is medical negligence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very interesting case. It will be under submission. So you are excused. Thank you. Have a good day and stay safe and healthy, please.